Wake up, everyone. It's time for the Steve Noble Show, where biblical Christianity meets the everyday issues of life in your home, at work, and even in politics. Steve is an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and on his show, there's plenty of grace and lots of truth, but no sacred cows. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Or check him out online at thestevenobleshow.com. And now, here's your host, Steve Noble.
Well, you may have noticed that America generally is not becoming kind of more and more Christian. It's becoming more and more diverse. So we've got not just the fact that you've got – still have about 73-74% of people in America will self-profess that they're Christians. Okay, so most people you run into in America will say they're Christian. Now, whether they actually are born again or not is another subject for another day. But most of them are still going to say that they're Christian. Okay, so that's group number one. The second largest group here in America – is people that, today now we call them nuns. Sorry, we call them nuns. That does not mean that they are necessarily atheistic. It doesn't even mean they're agnostic. It just means that they will not profess a religious affiliation. Most of them will say things like, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, or I'm spiritual, or I believe in a higher power, but I don't affiliate with a particular church. That's about 18% of the population. 2% of the population here in America are Jewish. They follow Judaism. 1.8% are Mormons. 1% are Buddhists. 1% are Hindus. Slightly less than eight tenths of a percent are Muslim, but that's growing. That's the fastest growing one outside of Christianity. And then Jehovah's Witnesses are about the same, at about 0.8%. So we are surrounded by world religion, even though we live here in the United States of America. Still predominantly, quote unquote, a Christian group here in America, but we do need to understand these other world religions. And what is the deal with each world religion? What is Judaism based on? Mormonism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, Jehovah's Witnesses, and especially in the American context, if you live in a normal neighborhood, sooner or later, you're going to hear a knock on your door, and there's going to be a Mormon or perhaps a Jehovah's Witness at your door who will tell you flat out, hey, we're Christians too, but are they really? Here on campus, we've had Dr. Ant Greenham on the show many times in the past, who has a really fascinating personal history, and then his time here, of course, at Southeastern. He's a professor, associate professor of missions and Islamic studies. And as soon as he says hello, you'll realize he's not from these parts. Dr. Ant Greenham, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Well, Steve, thank you very much for having me again. And I guess my accent betrays me. I like to say that I'm from North Carolina when I'm traveling, but nobody believes me.
Nobody's buying what you're saying.
No, I'm from South Africa, and I'm not going to lose the accent anytime soon. Been here for 18 years now, and have a background in foreign relations. I was in South African embassies in Israel, Jordan, and again, been here for 18 years, love being here, been teaching in the area of missions, Islam, and world religions in general. Been doing some practicums, meeting people of other faith backgrounds, love doing that.
Yeah, and it's. I hope you don't ever lose your accent, because even when your content is excellent, just the fact that you have an accent makes it even more interesting.
At least people are likely to listen. How long they'll listen for is another question.
Right. But it's always off to a good start, because how often when you meet people is their first question, where are you from?
Oh, my goodness. It just never stops.
Yeah. Well, which is great. That's a great kind of conversational starter and a great piece. Well, world religions, this is a fascinating topic, and I appreciate your willingness to go along with it. And we've done a lot of shows with Dr. Greenham in the past on Islam, because that's really his – when it comes to world religions, that's really at the center of his wheelhouse, and with his time in the Middle East, which we'll definitely do that again in the future. But when it comes to world religions, I was just kind of reading off the numbers here in America. So we've got most of them here. Should we be interested? Should we be engaged? How much of a point should it be for us, followers of Christ here in America, to understand and know much about other world religions?
Well, the answer is absolutely. And what the Lord has done is He brought people from all over the world and from other backgrounds. And it's a wonderful opportunity to interact with them, to get to know them, to befriend them, and to share the most important thing in our life with them, which of course is Jesus Christ.
And it's now, do you think we have to be experts in these other world religions in order to effectively witness to them?
The simple answer is no, but I think you do need to show some respect and interest and curiosity for what other folks believe. But essentially, what I tell students is typically the most important thing is to know really what you believe, and to be really focused on the central thing, which is Jesus Christ and His death on the cross for our sins and resurrection.
So what do you say to kind of a general notion? I know a lot of people that, especially young people, because it's a Thursday, so it's Theology Thursday as it is every week with our friends at Southeastern. But I'm coming off of three classes of high school age homeschoolers that I teach on Thursdays. A lot of them do speech and debate, and they're very much into the debate and dismantling their opponent's argument. Is that generally, and then we're going to dive into the individual aspects of each of these religions. We're going to talk about Judaism and Mormonism and Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam and Jehovah's Witnesses. We're going to kind of do a fast view through each of those. But oftentimes with my students, their main interest is in dismantling the other person's position, right? That's kind of a typical debate tactic. Should we approach people of other religions that way where I'm going to tell you what's wrong with Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, or should we not?
A simple answer is no, don't do that. Think of it from your own perspective. The first contact you have with someone who's slightly different from yourself, all they want to do is show you that you're wrong. You're an American, you have a whole bunch of things that are wrong with your country, and here they are, and you better change. And it's just, what kind of genuine interaction are you going to follow after that? You're going to have your back up, and you're going to be wanting to defend yourself, and typically the conversation will get heated, and thinking will kind of take a nosedive. So really, that's not the way at all. You need to know these things. It's good to have that apologetic background, but you need to use it very judiciously. And really, the point of having a relationship first and showing a person you're interested in them, not just in winning an argument, that's really important.
Yeah, and so we'll kind of unpack that, the apologetic side, as we walk through these different world religions that are right here in our own backyard. But I think it's important that we have a working knowledge of these different, especially in your context. So we live here in the Raleigh, Wake Forest area of North Carolina. There's a part of town, you mentioned this before we went on the air, Morrisville, which is kind of a suburb of Raleigh, near the airport. And in Morrisville, I know this because I used to own a house painting company, so I used to go down there a lot and give people prices. There are a lot of people, there's a lot of Hindus that live there. Mm-hmm. So if you're in a company, there's a lot of international companies here in the Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill area, and depending on where you live. But if you keep running into Hindus, that might be a good clarion call that you should start to educate yourself on Hinduism.
Exactly. I show an interest, and I have a couple of good friends who are in that area. They're actually not Hindu. They are respectively Jain and Sikh. But we were having dinner with them just last month and had a great time together. And so, yes, absolutely. One's going to rub shoulders with these people and to show an interest in what they believe, and also to have a conversation where one starts to compare and contrast. And
absolutely. Because most of the time it takes a while. It takes relationship. It takes conversation. It's not a McDonald's fast food drive-through most of the time.
No.
And it's okay to walk in pretty ignorant.
Sure.
It's actually fine. But it's important to show some interest and ask a lot of questions, but you should also study too. We'll dive into the specifics of these world religions when we come back right after this. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble. It is the Steve Noble Show, Theology Thursday, with our friends at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Dr. Ann Greenham is with us today, and Dr. Greenham has been on the show many times in the past, especially on the issue of Islam and understanding the Islamic faith, which we're going to get to. We're going to talk about that today. He's an associate professor of missions and Islamic studies here at Southeastern Baptist. And we're gonna get to Islam. That's definitely on the list as we talk about the world religions that really are present here in the United States. We still got about 74% of Americans that will self-identify as Christian. 18% would say they have no religious affiliation. 2% are Jewish. 1.8% are Mormons. 1% both Buddhism and Hinduism. And 0.8% for Islam and 0.8% for Jehovah's Witness. Of all of those, outside of Christianity, Islam is growing the fastest here in America. But we need to be conversant. We need to understand and especially invest in relationships with these folks. So we're going to do just kind of a primer on those various world religions. So we'll finish with Judaism and Islam. So let's start kind of at the bottom of the list in terms of the amount of people that are here. We'll start with Jehovah's Witnesses and Jehovah's Witnesses, and we'll do Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons. So let's start there. So what do we need to know generally about Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormonism?
Big question. Let me do the best I can on this. Firstly, Jehovah's Witnesses actually grew out of the Millerites. Millerites, of course, had this idea that Jesus would return somewhere between March 1843 and March 1844. Didn't happen, called the Year of the Great Disappointment. And essentially, an offshoot of that eventually developed into the Seventh-day Adventists, but an offshoot of that were the Jehovah's Witnesses. And they're very focused on on the year 1914, they say that's when Christ ascended into his heavenly glory. And the way they get that number, it seems that it was actually a failed prophecy, but they clung to it. And a key number in the book of Revelation, 1260 days, it was equivalent to 3.5 years. They double that and it becomes 2520. They do that in years, and then you subtract 2520 years from 1914, and you get the year 607. And well, what happened in 607? Yeah. Well, actually, nothing much. The problem is, because it's so important in the eschatological scheme, they say that the temple was destroyed in 607. Mm. That's about 20 years out. There's just no reputable scholar of any kind who would go with a 607. But when you confront Jehovah's Witnesses with that, basically they would say, no, this is secular teaching. We can't take it seriously. It doesn't come from the Bible. And so they basically don't pay any attention to it. So the idea is that it's a very closely knit community. They care for each other, support each other. But oh my, if you break away from the Jehovah's Witnesses, you'll be shunned. You'll lose all your community.
Yeah. So when you're asking them to walk away from that and embrace biblical Christianity, you're asking them to walk away from their entire life.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we need to be sensitive to that. What does the Jehovah's Witness believe about God?
Well, they use the word Jehovah to refer to him, and essentially the really important thing to realize is that they don't see Jesus as God at all. They see him as a created being. And one of the things that I've picked up from my contact who left the Jehovah's Witness movement is when he began reading the Bible, he realized that there was far more to Jesus than the Jehovah's Witnesses made out. Mm. And, you know, really it comes back to the whole issue of salvation. And unfortunately, so much of the Jehovah's Witness movement is focused on this eschatological thing. They're looking forward to a paradise on earth. The vast majority never hope to go to heaven because only 144,000 literally will go to heaven. So the vast majority of millions of JWs will never have that hope. But they have a hope on earth, but it's eschatological. And unfortunately, what's happened here is the soteriological aspects have been lost. And again, this comes back to the important thing. We have to understand our own faith to really appreciate what's wrong with or where we can question the others. And of course, Jesus has to be God to save us. Only God can save, but he has to be man to save us. That's why he has to be the God-man. And when that's thrown out the window, really, you can't be sure of your salvation. Yeah. And then, so how do you keep yourself in salvation? Witness. They have to keep record of this. When they're out and about, they call it publishing. Active. And basically, it's just a tremendous burden.
Yeah.
That they're under the whole time.
And so what's in terms of a tactic in sharing the gospel with them, what would you suggest?
Well, they take the Bible very seriously. Unfortunately, it's their own translation, so there's some questionable aspects which show that they don't really have serious Greek or Hebrew scholarship behind it. But it seems to me that the Hebrew Bible hasn't been translated quite as poorly as the Greek one. And one of the things I like to point out is that if you look through the claims of Christ in the New Testament and what the Old Testament says about God, there's simply no other conclusion to draw but that Jesus Christ really is God.
Yeah, yeah.
And so to actually have a Bible study with them, perhaps starting in the Old Testament, would be one thing to do. Mm. But the question really is, are you prepared to devote the kind of time that would...
Exactly. Because this isn't a one-stop shop at your front door.
Exactly.
It takes a lot. And you got to understand that going into it, that no matter what you say, not that God can't do a miracle right there on your front porch. Of course, he can. But most of the time, the vast majority of the time, it's going to take time.
Sure.
And you have to realize, and you have to make the decision, do you really care enough
yeah.
that you're going to spend the time, do your homework, and invest in that relationship? What about Mormonism?
Well, it all goes back to Joseph Smith.
All the way back to Joseph.
Yeah, their prophet and... he made claims that the Father and the Son appeared to him, and then an angel basically revealed the translation of his golden tablets to him, and he dictated it from behind a curtain to somebody who was writing it all down, and the individual apparently never actually saw the golden tablets, and basically... Joseph Smith is really, really huge for the Mormons, and basically he reestablishes the church, they say, which was in a state of apostasy from the earliest times. A very pretty much from the time of the apostles until the early 19th century, the church was in apostasy. So basically, we'd have to write off people like Luther, Calvin, Spurgeon. None of those could be genuine Christians, according to the Mormons. But now they've reestablished the church. So hence, it's a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Got it.
And they like to call themselves that. They use the word Mormon, but they've kind of trying to distance themselves from that. I'm not sure how successful that's going to be. Mormon is pretty strongly fixed in American mindset.
Well, when you see a lot of their advertising online, which is excellent, and they advertise heavily. You see a lot of their stuff on YouTube and a lot of other places on some popular websites. They've shown up occasionally on Glenn Beck's website. Probably not so much anymore since The Blaze combined with Conservative Review and stuff. But you see some – and Mormons do excellent radio advertisements. I don't know if you've ever heard them.
Mormons
but very pro-family, father, son, kids. It sounds like the Southern Baptist Convention or your average evangelical group put it out.
Yeah, Mormons are very sophisticated people, make no mistake, and very hardworking. When I was in Salt Lake City, I was struck by the logo of the city as a beehive. Mm. That tells you what you need to know about Mormons.
Yeah.
Busy, busy, busy people.
Busy.
And very, very efficient. My endontologist is a Mormon, and my goodness, he gives me excellent care. So, you know, in terms of good American citizens, you simply can't fault these people. But then, looking at what they do with the Bible, this is the tricky thing. They will use the same terminology,
right?
But they mean something very different by it.
Yep, it's. I often say that with Mormonism, and I don't know if you taught me this or where I learned this, but for the most part, we have the same vocabulary, mm-hmm. but a totally different dictionary.
Yeah,
and that's we're going to get into that with Dr. Ant Greenham when we come back, because we're working our way through the world religions, the ones that are here, especially in America. So we talked about Jehovah's Witnesses. Right now, we're on Mormonism. After that, we'll go to Buddhism and Hinduism. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. It's Theology Thursday with our friends at Southeastern Baptist, talking to Dr. Ant Greenham today about the world religions that are right here in the United States of America. So we need to be somewhat educated on this so that we can understand where people are coming from. You also need to understand these different world religions. So it helps you in terms of trying to invest in these people and get to know them and having a relationship and understanding the kind of the road that's out there and what you're dealing with. And then properly at the right time and trusting in the power of the Holy Spirit and the leadership of the Spirit. Having gospel-centered conversations. But the point is, and we mentioned this at the beginning of the show with Dr. Greenham, our point isn't to walk in there, dismantle their religion, and that's going to win them over. And remember, it's the kindness of God that leads people to repentance. It's not your ability to destroy their religion. So it takes some investment. And I think that's where most of us have no interest in spending time with people of other religions, because simply we just don't care enough to spend the time. We don't want to make the investment. And so when they come to your front door, especially Jehovah's Witnesses, and we're talking about Mormons right now, you're hoping for the home run and you're hoping that, you know, I told them. But that's not really the heart of Christ. They need to know the truth. But it's going to take some time to work through that, to build a relationship and then build some trust so they'll actually listen to you. But we have to ask a lot of questions and be invested in them as human beings. And remember that Jesus died for them too. Okay, they have inestimable worth just like you do. And we need to take that into account when we interact with people of other world religions. But we're talking about Mormonism, which can be very – we said this earlier. Same vocabulary. They're going to talk about atonement. They're going to talk about Jesus. They're going to talk about God. They're going to talk about the Bible. They're going to talk about heaven. But totally different dictionaries. So their meanings behind these things is what takes you down the road. You find out quickly that Mormonism isn't anywhere near biblical Christianity. But for Mormonism, and this is where it gets kind of strange, Dr. Greenham, and again, thank you for being here today.
Sure.
To a Mormon, who is God? What is God?
Well, they have an idea that there's a God who was once a man, and essentially he got himself to where he is now. And there are multiple different, you can perhaps call them universes, where you have a different God over each one, and they hope for the same thing themselves. A movie was made some years back called The God Makers, and that in many ways captures what Mormon is all about. They're making themselves into God and gods. And
so a Mormon, a really good Mormon, could ultimately one day become a god.
Absolutely.
And in this case, they get their own planet.
And have eternal families.
Yeah, they can have their own spirit children.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, but the Mormons don't talk about that.
They
much.
Don't say that up front, no. But it's definitely part of the belief system.
Yeah. So their notion of God is totally off. What do they believe about Jesus? Who is Jesus for Mormonism?
Effectively, he becomes it's closer to tritheism than anything else. So you had a separate God, the Father, separate God, the Son, separate God, the Holy Spirit. And so that's kind of where it
is. And don't Mormons believe Jesus and Satan have kind of an interesting relationship?
Yeah, there's some interesting things there. But, you know, really what you want to do with the Mormon is get them to see in their Bible that what they believe is actually at variance. And I was alluding earlier to Galatians 1, 8, and 9. This is not like a catch-all, but if you can get them to point out, yes, that Joseph Smith came with a different gospel. It was revealed to him by an angel. And then have a look in their Bible, which, of course, is the King James Version. What does Paul say about if an angel from heaven comes with a different gospel?
With a different gospel.
Let him be accursed. And that's not going to win them over, but just to point out, we've got a problem here, and it's well-founded, not because we are antagonistic towards you, but the truth really matters.
Yeah, because you can go to the scriptures with them.
Yes.
Because they use King James Bible.
You've got to be careful. They use the phrase, insofar it's properly translated.
Right.
So that becomes a bit of a cop-out.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, they do have their own, you really want them to see it, read it for themselves in their own scriptures. Which would be the King James.
And you mentioned earlier, a little bit off the cuff, but it's an important and an interesting dynamic. Baptism for the dead.
Yes.
So you got all these really strange things in the Mormon temple. And once you got to get in pretty deep to understand this. And that's why people ask me when I talk about Glenn Beck, because a lot of people don't know that Glenn Beck is a totally committed Mormon. And so Glenn Beck knows all the ins and outs of Mormon doctrine and Mormon theology, gets very ticked off when people say that he's not a Christian. He's really offended by that. But there's a lot of strange things that happen in the temple and kind of the inner sanctum, the holy underwear. He actually talked about that. He did a whole show about that on Fox once when he used to be on Fox. But what's baptism of the dead?
Well, it's based on that obscure verse in 1 Corinthians 15. And, of course, all that Paul is doing there is simply pointing out that baptism is real. Otherwise, why would people get baptized on behalf of the dead? Now, of course, what that means is open to question, and we could spend a lot of time on that. But essentially, the idea is if you get baptized on behalf of someone that is one of your ancestors, then it's as if a voice is spoken, and that person hears the voice, and it's an opportunity for them to respond and be translated from the rather miserable position they're in to a better place.
Yeah, and of course, really no sound biblical reasoning behind that. All right, let's shift. So these are kind of uniquely American things, even though they spread out, but their origins are here. Buddhism and Hinduism.
Yes.
Which one do you want to start with? Does it matter? I'd like to do similarities and differences.
We should start with Hinduism because Buddhism grew out of Hinduism, so just to keep it historical. But am I saying that in a way that's missing the whole point of Buddhism and Hinduism, because they tend to have a circular view of time, not a linear view of time like we do. And so what you'd often have is just the idea that this is the way things are. And so there's a lot of complexity in Hinduism, some very, very intelligent people, Hindu philosophy, something one really needs to take seriously. Now, I'm not saying that the average person in the street should now buy a book on Hindu philosophy before they can talk to a Hindu. But there's two things here. There's the philosophical Hinduism, which is basically everything is one. And so basically everything is part of God. There's not a separation between God, creator, and creation. It's all part of God. They call everything that is Brahman, and he emanates and reabsorbs. So which is quite different to the idea of creation. So we are part of God. So the typical Hindu greeting of Namaste, where they put their hands together and bow to you, that means I see God in you. Mm. And it's a philosophical understanding. And so we all part of God. But then the problem is we gather this karma. And it's a very intense cause and effect. And from a human point of view, it makes a lot of sense. Basically, why do bad things happen? And, of course, we all struggle with this. The origin of evil, problem of evil, it's something that every human being on the face of the planet has to deal with to a greater or lesser extent. But essentially, there's a very simple answer for it. If you are having a bad time now, whether the way you're born or experiences you're having, that's because of the way you behave badly in a previous life. And also what you're doing now is going to affect the way that you're going to be in a future life. So essentially, what goes around comes around. And it keeps coming around and around and around. That's called samsara. And so reincarnation for the Hindu isn't a good thing. They really want to escape the whole thing altogether. They call that moksha. And so that would be the equivalent of salvation. Basically, you escape from the endless cycle of returns.
Escape to what?
And to be reabsorbed with Brahman. But again, there's some different philosophical positions on this. Some say there's no distinction between Atman, the self, and Brahman, God. You just be reabsorbed, like droplets in an ocean, sure, or sparks in a, sure, fire. Others say, no, there's still some sense of identity which you keep. And so, again, these go into the niceties of Hindu philosophy. But, you know, that's the philosophical area. For most Hindus, it's like, yeah, I'm going to come again and come again and come again. But they're concerned for things like most people are, which is just their families, their job, getting on with life. And so typically worshipping a local god, so each village would have its own set of gods. Of course, there's some gods which are particularly popular.
Because this is anything but monotheistic.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Because we're talking a few hundred million, right?
330 million is
that all? Okay,
the standard. That's a standard 330 million. Yeah, as a standard.
How old is Hinduism?
It's very hard to say because we don't have clear archaeological evidence. It's interesting, Narendra Modi, Prime Minister of India, he's pushing Hinduism in a big way now, wanting to make all of India Hindu, which of course is a very dangerous thing to do, yes, given you've got some very significant minorities there. But I would say it's probably originated 3 to 4 millennia ago.
Was there a founder?
Of a boundary?
Was there a founder?
No founder at all. So essentially, it seems to have evolved. There were some praise songs in the early writings, and then later philosophical Hinduism and commentary on the early writings, yeah, emerged. And then, of course, you have a very, very popular scripture called the Bhagavad Gita. And what's interesting with this is that you've got this man, his name is Arjuna. He's in the Kshatriya caste. It's a warrior ruler caste. And he's about to go into battle against other Kshatriyas, of course, because they're the guys who fight. So he's concerned about this. I'm going to be killing my cousins, so I'd rather not do this. And it turns out his chariot driver is actually the god Krishna in disguise, and then gives him a lecture on basically it's better to do the work of your own caste badly than the work of another caste well. But then beyond that, there's another thing that you can do, which is devotion. If you find a god and you're devoted to that god, that's probably the best way to achieve moksha.
Yeah.
So that's probably the most popular form of
Hinduism.
Yeah,
so it doesn't matter which god, just pick
it's
one
called,
and write
it's
it.
Called bhakti Hinduism, which is basically devotional Hinduism.
Got it. And we'll talk about one of the challenges with Hindus is that they're willing to put another one on the shelf. And another one, in this case, could be Jesus Christ himself.
Oh, absolutely. This is the big thing. Will they accept Jesus as another god? Sure.
Sure, why not? Sure. How can it hurt? We'll be right back.
All my life I've been searching for something. Something never comes, never leads to nothing. Nothing satisfies, but I'm getting close. Closer to the prize at the end of the rope.
I always let that one play out because even though it's the Foo Fighters, which is not exactly praise and worship music, you listen to that lyric, I think you can probably figure out why I put that in there. This is Steve Noble on the Steve Noble Show. It is Theology Thursday, as it is every week with our friends at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Dr. Ant Greenham is in here today. He's an associate professor of missions, and especially with Islam, that's really the center of its wheelhouse, and a great background from South Africa. And then how long did you serve as a diplomat in the Middle East?
In the Middle East, probably about eight years, but in that career, 15 and a half.
How do you look back at your time in the Middle East?
Oh, I love it. I wish I could spend more time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What did you love about it?
Oh, I think just the fascination of things being different, but also, let me be honest, being in Israel and Jordan, where I had my two postings, this is where so much of the biblical story happened. And so you can be there, and the culture hasn't changed that much, and you can just realize this is what the Bible is actually like. It just comes alive.
What a deep historical context you all of a sudden have.
But then meeting with people who are hospitable and then yet also think very differently. And so having to be on your toes intellectually the whole time, it was just a...
Oh, man, how invigorating.
Yeah, exactly, invigorating.
Would you say that... And then we'll dive back in. Would you say that the Middle Eastern culture breeds a lot more hospitality than the American culture?
Oh, no question about it.
Like, I mean, I'm talking about opposite ends of the world.
No question about it, yeah. Yes.
That was my experience, too. I mean, there and the same thing, I ran into that in Africa, too, and a couple of mission trips I've been to there. But when we spend a little bit of time in northern Iraq, I mean, it's shocking, the hospitality.
They
see you on the street, and we're just walking through a neighborhood prayer walking, and they'll come out and engage. And the next thing you know, you're sitting in their family room for 3 hours.
Exactly.
That would almost never happen here. They'd be calling the cops.
Exactly. Robert Kaplan writes a book. He's a secular Jewish writer called Earning the Rockies, and he was traveling across the country just to get a feel of what America's like. And he was describing the typical friendliness one encounters in the Midwest. So he's very quick to add, friendliness is not hospitality. Friendliness is to grease business. They're not going to invite you into your home, okay? Their home.
Yeah, there's a big difference.
In the Middle East, they will invite you in.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's just amazing. It made me uncomfortable because they treat you with such esteem and such worth.
It's
really an amazing thing and a great lesson for all of us, especially those of us that are followers of Christ. So for Hinduism, and then we're going to talk about Buddhism, and then we'll finish with Islam. For Hinduism, I would imagine one of the biggest challenges, we mentioned this going into the break, is that they're more than willing to listen about Jesus.
Yes.
And then just add them to the collection.
Sure. And this is, as I said, part of the so-called bhakti Hinduism, which is devotional Hinduism. And so you'd worship a god partly to hopefully give you moksha, escape from the endless cycle of reincarnation, but also for everyday life concerns. A lot of people are just concerned about life. And so that can be a very good beginning with a Hindu person. Remember, they're another human being made in God's image. They have needs. You could offer to pray for them. I know we were talking about Morrisville earlier, part of greater Raleigh area, and a lot of Indian folks there. I know someone who ministers there, and essentially he will ask folks what he can pray for them, and inevitably they'll have an answer.
Yeah, and then you just
build into that. I was with him just a couple of months ago, and the waiter was asked, "Well, he's here, his family isn't here, he got visa issues. Yeah, please pray for me about that." So.
Yeah.
They're concerned about everyday life issues.
Yeah, they're just like the rest of us.
Yeah.
Have you seen or know about much spiritual fruit with Hindus?
It's very slow. And, you know, you've got a strong Christian community in India, and you have Christian communities here, folks from India. But to see people moving from Hinduism in a significant way, no, we haven't seen anything like that.
Yeah, it's sad. What about Buddhism?
Well, the Buddhists basically started, it's a movement away from Hinduism. Essentially, you've got these different castes. Castes is a Portuguese word. It's actually varnas, perhaps a better word to use if we're talking about the Hindus. But they have these different stratifications. And the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, he was actually a member of the ruling warrior caste. And one of his ideas is that the whole caste system should be abolished entirely. And essentially, anybody can achieve enlightenment. Enlightenment's very similar to the Hindu idea of moksha. And so what he done is...
Do they also use the word nirvana?
Yes, nirvana is the ultimate place where they're headed. So nirvana is where you... Let me back up. The big problem with Buddhism, they say, with Buddhism, everyone you speak to will agree that there's something wrong with the human condition. There's something wrong with people. But then that agreement quickly evaporates, because what is wrong there, you have all sorts of answers.
Sure, yeah.
But what the Buddhists will say is that the problem is attachment, is desire. And because of attachment, it weighs us down. That's what keeps us coming back in terms of ongoing lives. They also believe in reincarnation like the Hindus do. But that's the problem. And you have to escape this attachment in some way. And so he tried to go the way of the ascetic, realized that didn't work. He'd already grown up in a very comfortable, wealthy situation as a prince, and then he formed a middle way where you kind of practical, but where you can essentially distance yourself from desire, and that way you will achieve enlightenment.
Finally escape.
And you will not keep coming back.
Now, do they believe in multiple gods like Hindus?
This is where it gets complicated. Once you start looking at the nitty-gritty of Buddhism as actually practiced, what's tend to happen is there's an amalgamation of the religions which were there before Buddhism came along. And they're both to be folk religions, and they've been absorbed into different forms of Buddhism. So Buddhism has strikingly different manifestations as you go across different parts of Asia. And, of course, some of that's been brought here to America too. So, yes, many Buddhists will have that. But in terms of the pure Buddhism, no, there was no God at all. Essentially, pristine Buddhism is atheistic. What the Buddha said is, this is useless speculation. Here's the way to escape suffering. Suffering is caused by desire. Here's a way to escape it. Follow this. Don't speculate about whether there's a God or not. It's not going to help you. I mean, of course, if Nirvana.
You just have to escape your infatuation with desire and everything.
Of everything, good and bad. So if you love somebody very deeply, that's attachment as well. Exactly, because you're going to suffer because that relationship won't last forever.
Right.
And so
I can see a lot of people liking Buddhism.
Yeah.
Because they can see nothing works.
Yeah.
And the bad stuff gets spoiled. The good stuff's bad. I mean, the bad stuff's good.
So, really, you know, non-attachment, which is not totally different.
Generally, how would you approach a Buddhist?
It's tricky. And I think the spiritual element, I think, is where we have to go with. What I mean is always look for opportunities to tell the gospel story because the Holy Spirit uses the gospel
story. That's right. That's right.
But Buddhists tend to be very intellectual. So if you're trying to argue your way out of Buddhism, often they will just get more deeply entrenched into
all kinds of rabbit trails, I would imagine.
Yeah. So, again, I would say a lot would depend on the Buddhist you're talking to and having a discussion, asking questions, and agreeing, yes, life is suffering.
Yeah, yeah.
But then what I find fascinating is there are two things which Jesus said in one verse. It's in Luke 22 to his disciples. I've earnestly desired to partake of this Passover before I suffer. So he's embracing both desire and suffering.
Yeah, how about that?
Which is totally different.
Yeah, that's a mind bender for a Buddhist. Yeah.
Desire and suffering, which he embraces both together in the same verse.
Yeah. So we'll do just a little tiny little bit on Islam because we're almost out of time. But how do we approach Islam just generally? And then we'll have you back on and we'll do a full show on Islam the next time we have Dr. Ant Greenham in here. But help us just understand generally what Islam is all about.
Yes, I'd say the simplest thing to understand about Islam is it's essentially submission to an unknowable God. And look, there's a lot of questions about how Islam really began. Islamic tradition will tell you that Muhammad basically introduced monotheism to a pagan culture. It's not clear if that was really the case. But you don't need to have that kind of discussion with a Muslim. You're just going to make him upset if you say that. But the problem is there was a very clear revelation of the Lord Jesus Christ and who he is and what he done in the New Testament at the time that Islam came on the scene. So that is being rejected for something else. And what often happens, and this would apply to more religions than just Islam, is that people reject the clear revelation, and in this place they say, well, we don't know. And so God is unknowable. And so here's the thing. You submit to an unknowable God. Now, his will is known. Perform the five pillars, you know, the confession, prayer, almsgiving, fasting, pilgrimage, all those things. That you must do, that's clear. You know exactly what his will is, but him you don't know. And so then the question becomes, what will happen to you on the Day of Judgment? And Muslims simply have to say they don't know.
They don't know.
Because they don't know God, and so they don't know what will happen. They just do their best and hope for the best.
So is it true? Because a lot of Americans assume the only way for a Muslim to actually know they're going to paradise is to martyr themselves.
Yes, a small minority will take that position. And unfortunately, there are Islamic texts which will support them doing that. I need to add very quickly, though, that the vast majority of Muslims are not like that. And you see, this whole idea of an unknowable God, it can go two ways. It can affect a small minority who then feel, we have to perform jihad to get out of this.
We have to.
But the vast majority say, well, we don't know, so let's just leave it to the mercy of God and hope for the best.
Yeah, kind of a casualness.
Yes, and most Muslims are like that.
Yeah, most Muslims, because I think the numbers I've seen, probably 80% of Muslims worldwide are much more the casual type.
Sure.
They'd be a great neighbor, good friend, a good worker, good boss.
Absolutely.
But 20% who
I'd say it's smaller than that. But,
yeah, smaller than that. But the zeal there, and their only hope is through jihad, and it's the type of violent jihad that most of us think of. Yeah. We'll have you back again because I want to do a much more in-depth look at Islam and the different versions of Islam, because there's a lot there. It's a very complicated thing, but it is the second biggest religion on the face of the planet, and that's why we need to spend some time with Dr. Ann Greenham next time. Dr. Greenham, thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
All right, friends, this is Steve Noble on The Steve Noble Show. God willing, I'll talk to you again real soon. And like my dad always said, ever forward.